Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to author G.D. Grace's A Touch of Grace, Literary Magic, on Blog Talk Radio.
It's that time again. I am your host, G.D. Welcome to iArtist Presents on A Touch of Grace. Today's date is February 6, 2014, and the time is 1:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Black History Month personifies the courage existence of defiance trailblazers. Let me try this again. I don't know what's going on. It personifies the courageous existence of defiant trailblazers who set the demanding flame for equal treatment of African-American people on a global scale. Although civil rights was aimed at African-American people in the beginning, the human theme for equality doesn't just mean African-American. It also means equal and fair treatment for every human being around the globe. In keeping with my promise, at the start of the month, I'd like to recognize one of those courageous figures who stepped forward from oppressive shadows to become an icon in the fight for equality. Rosa Louise McCauley Arx was born February 4, 1913. She was an African-American civil rights activist whom the United States Congress called the First Lady of Civil Rights and the Mother of the Freedom Movement. On December 1, 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, Parks refused to obey bus driver James F. Blake's order to give up her seat in the colored section of the bus after the white section had been filled. She was not the first to resist, but segregation. Others had taken similar steps in the 20th century and were arrested months before Parks. However, the NAACP organizers believed Rosa Parks was the best candidate for seeing through a court challenge after her arrest for civil disobedience in violating Alabama segregation laws. Her act of defiance, along with the historical Montgomery bus boycott, became important symbols of courage in the modern civil rights movement. She became an international icon to the resistance of racial segregation until her death on October 24, 2005. We celebrate her on A Touch of Grace for her courage and sacrifice, taking a stand for equality against injustice. And now, the moment has come. Kevin E. Taylor, master of multitasking, has been a pastor for 14 years. He has been a writer and producer in television for several years, and he runs his very own video production company called TM3. He authored his first book, Jaded, and published it in 2003 after leaving Black Entertainment Television. He was a top 10 seller on several Amazon charts, and since then, he has released several others, including his latest full-length novel, Meet the Hendersons. Post-BET, he became a full-time pastor. He is a lecturer, empowerment speaker who has spoken at colleges, universities, and community groups for over 20 years, and also conducted a series of workshops on pitching a TV show idea to uncluttering your life. He and I we both share something in common. We're both big Natalie Cole fans. And he has several pictures posted posing with her on Facebook. Natalie is celebrating her 64th birthday today. And you know what? She's still quite stunning. I welcome Kevin E. Taylor to iArtist on A Touch of Grace. Hey, Kevin, how you doing?
I am spectacularly well, thank you, good sir. How are you?
Well, you know what? I'm jumping all over my words today. I don't know what's going on, but I am just excited to have you on the show.
It's
so what
Natalie
have you been
Cole
up to,
Day, that's why. You're flustered.
Well, you told me that. And when I looked on your Facebook post, I saw all of these pictures with her. Now, you know, I got to tell you something. When I was younger, and Natalie was in the I've Got Love on My Mind era, my brother and sister used to tease me all the time because I was just so crazy. I mean, you couldn't say nothing about her because I cop an attitude. So I definitely love Natalie Cole as well. So what is she like? I just have to ask that question.
She is like a big sister, you know. She's very kind of, come here, sit down, you know. It's very interesting because, you know, when some people meet you backstage, they like to keep the allure up, and Natalie is very quick to kind of take off the gown or the dress that she's wearing to put on something a lot more accessible. So it's interesting to meet the fully made up face-wise, but with a different, like, more let's get ready to go out street dress on. She's, you know, it's odd. It's odd, you know, because the 11-year-old boy still goes to Natalie Cole concerts. He just happens to go in my 49-year-old body. And, you know, for her to be my big sister is a trip. It's a trip every single time. That's all I can say. So happy birthday, Natalie.
Well, happy birthday, Natalie Cole. She certainly is one for history. I mean, her father was a great man in history as well, Nat King Cole. And I know that Natalie has had her health battles, but she really has come back strong, and I am so happy about that. But today is about you, my friend. You have a platinum resume.
Wow.
So the question I have is, mm-hmm. did you ever believe you would be as successful as you have become?
What I know for sure is that I, from a very young age, believed God. I didn't believe in God. I believed God. And so when I read Jeremiah 29, I know the plans I have for you, and they are plans to prosper you with a good life and a future. I believed that. And so it always seemed to make sense that some of the oddities, the proclivities that I had as a little boy, like the first book I ever read was the dictionary. You know, that they were preparing me for something else. And, you know, I would sit at our couch, on our couch of the projects and do interviews, you know, because my asthma was so bad, especially in the summer. I couldn't even go outside. So that's how I engaged myself. So I always, all of this feels completely awesome and completely in conjunction with the little boy who was dreaming. I had no idea, you know, about this. You know, you talk about a touch of grace. I have had a truckload of grace, you know, to back
wow.
up into my life and have this happen. But you know, I am without shame in saying there is a reason at least weekly where I break down in tears for the grace of God. Something falls out of something. I walk past and see something. Somebody says something. Somebody emails me and says something. So it's not something that I'm ever disconnected from. I'm always operating, you know, from a space of grace.
All right. Well, you said that so eloquently, and I could definitely see how you could be so engaging speaking live. And that is something that one day I will get a chance to see.
I look forward.
Oh, yeah. You know, I think that you are a phenomenal speaker, and your spirit just radiates. And your list of stellar accomplishments parallels the prestigious titles following your name. So where did life begin for you, and what was, I know that you were a little boy and you had asthma and you stayed in the house, but what was the quintessential point in your life that you discovered your divine purpose in life?
So I was, you know, if you read the For Colored Boys anthology that came out, my piece was called Pop Quiz in that. And I begin it as I begin every lecture that I give. I was born a fat, black, asthmatic, gay nerd in the projects of Southwest Washington, D.C. And so that's where I grew up. I grew up in a two-bedroom tenement with three brothers and my mom. We had our room and mama's room. And, you know, the kitchen bled right into the living room, right into the hallway. And I had no idea that we were poor because it was such a rich life. It was, you know, you had friends and, you know, a community of people who took care of one another. And so that was my life. And, you know, in between my horrific bouts with asthma, you know, and even that, just seeing teachers, and, you know, I remember in the fourth grade when I got sick, they brought the entire class to see me in the hospital, you know, something they probably would never do today. But it was just, we were a community of people. And that's the little boy I was. That's the little nerd I was until, like I said, the day I found an old Merriam-Webster pocket dictionary in the trash when I had thrown out the trash and found this dictionary and just made it my life course to learn these words. And I don't know why. I don't know what it was about it that made me be drawn to it, except it was a book, and I like books, and what else was I going to do? And
when we, as we did earlier, talk about Natalie Cole, this is really why I love Natalie Cole. Her music is a blessing to my soul. But I remember the day in 1975 when on a show called The Mike Douglas Show, Natalie Cole was mentioned as one of the three guests. And I knew who she was because her name sounded so much like her father's. And my mother was a huge Nat King Cole fan. So I knew, uh-oh, somebody black's going to be on TV. You know, for people of our generation, we know what a big deal it was back in the 70s, you know. And so when he introduced her, she came out and she sang This Will Be, which sounded like a church song. And we were, you know, churchgoers, Cameron Baptist Church in Southwest D.C. So that kind of already got me. And then when she sat down, he asked her about, he said, well, tell me about your album. And she said, my album is called Inseparable. And I was like, you know, little 11-year-old boy in the project. I was like, inseparable. What does that mean? So I broke out my dictionary, never separated, you know, joined together in an internal bond. And just like most of us from that generation, when we learned new words, we had to learn how to spell them, define them, and use them in a sentence. So I'm looking at the album cover so I could spell it. I picked up my dictionary. Now I could define it, but it was too big to use in a sentence for me. I didn't know how to do that at the time. And the next song she sang was Inseparable. And so when she said we're like a flower to a tree, like words to a melody of love, there's no way we can break up, no words that can make us blow our thing, because we're just inseparable. My brain blew out of the skull and the framing of my head, because this is coming out of this beautiful brown-skinned young black woman's mouth, and I was changed. And then it continued, because when Mike Douglas asked her when she started singing, she said she started her junior year of college. And until that moment, I had no idea that black people could go to college.
Oh, wow.
So by the time my mother got home from her third job, she said, baby, you finish your homework? I said, yes, ma'am, because I'm going to college. And my mother was like, what? 11, what? And I kept saying it, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. And one day when I turned 16, my mother sat me down to have this conversation about, you know, like our finances and how she couldn't afford for me to go to college. And I was like, I know that, mommy. That's why I'm smart, because they pay for you to go to college when you're smart.
That is just precious, I have to tell you. So as a little boy with Webster Dictionary in your hand and a beautiful muse called Natalie Cole, it kind of jump-started a wonderful life that would lead into television, okay? So, but before we go into the television part, I want to talk about your college years. So you did make it to college. What college did you attend?
I went to Guilford College, which is a Quaker liberal arts school in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I went there because I got a pretty healthy SAT score. And my counselor started to then take me, you know, we started to go on college tours. And you were sitting in, you know, everywhere from Howard to Yale and seeing these huge classrooms. And you could see people fighting, like fighting to, you know, take notes and, you know, covering it. It just felt like they were so busy buried in the books and in the pages that they weren't paying attention to the teacher, like they weren't engaged. And so as all of the college materials start to come in, you know, from everywhere, from Stanford to Wabash University, which was in, like, Indiana, you know, I started to put them in the I would never go there, the maybes and the wow, this looks really interesting. And when the materials came from Guilford College, this Quaker liberal arts school in Greensboro, North Carolina, its promotional motto was, you know, Guilford College, where your only competition is you. And as a young black boy who had been fighting against being a nerd and being asthmatic and being smart and being, you know, gay in the projects, I didn't feel like another life where I had to continue fighting with people. I wanted to fight with myself to be my best self. And so they got me. They got me with that motto, where your only competition is yourself. And so, you know, even in my high school yearbook, it says that Kevin, you know, likes reading, writing, poetry, collecting Natalie Cole memorabilia, and will attend Guilford College, you know, after graduation. And that was in my junior year, because I knew it. It said what my soul needed. I needed to go be the most Kevin I could be without fighting to prove who that was to other people. And
that's
so
fantastic.
I was an English, Spanish, and accounting major. I ended up triple majoring.
Wow.
Well,
so
I mean, because
really
I went in to do accounting, and because I loved words, I took English and Spanish every semester. And so kind of junior year, they were like, you realize that you've got enough credits in each of these to kind of mine, to major if you blank in your senior year. So when most people kind of coast their senior year, I kind of doubled up on English and Spanish just because I liked it and I had the room for it. So
you really just have a love for higher education and learning. And you know the
words. Oh, I have a love for words.
Wow. And so you had mentioned the book For Colored Boys and the experience of, you know, being black and being a nerd, but then also tack on the being gay part, you know. So what were the struggles that you faced there, or did you just not even acknowledge them and you just kept going? What was that
like? It wasn't even the not acknowledging. You know, if you growing up in the project, I've often told people that, being fat and being a nerd and being gay, I don't know which one I got terrorized about most, you know, because when you speak like I did then and using words like recalcitrant and obsequious in conversation in the hood, people look at you like you're some sort of, you know, crazy three-headed monster. I remember walking down the street one day trying to figure out how to spell anti-disestablishmentarianism. Because I had heard it was like the biggest word in a spelling bee. So I was like, you know, walking down the street, spelling this word, and these dudes were walking towards me looking like, who does that? You know, you can see it on their faces. So the gay part was very interesting because there were times when, like, I still remember vividly the group of five dudes who chased me home trying to fight me and literally throwing stuff at me while I was running. And in 2 weeks' time, all five of those dudes had propositioned me. Separately.
Interesting.
So the stigma of it was always off of me because, you know, in that moment I was like, okay, so, you know.
So you learned early on about
you
down.
You say that because of people around you, but you and I both know that you slipped me a note, and I still have the note. I don't know if you thought it was Mission Impossible and it disintegrated. I still have the note, so. Funny,
okay,
you know.
Well, that's. Well, so you learned about the download at an early age. So
and
what
we
I
know, we
do,
said the download trade in the closet, all of those things. You know, we've been hearing them for a lifetime. So
yeah, and it's definitely still something in the black community that the community as a whole is still struggling with. So I want to talk about your television part, but what I want to go in because it seems so natural is I want to talk about your spiritual journey. So as a minister, because you are a minister, and then being gay on top of that, I just want to know, what was that like entering into that realm?
And so so much of who I am, you know, was solidified when I was a young adult, somewhere in my preteen to teen years. And I grew up in Caron Baptist Church in Southwest Washington, D.C., where Reverend Leroy S. Waldo was my pastor, praise God. And Reverend Waldo was blind and played the piano like Ray Charles. And he used to, I remember when on certain Sundays the Waldo singers would sing, and it was a small ensemble from the choir, and he would come out of the pulpit and play on piano. And it was just, it was everything to me. And that pastor, you know, I thank God that I grew up in an environment where he preached about love. He made God so awesome and so everyday and so reachable in this love ethic. And no matter what, and no matter when, and no matter who, God loved, God is great. And so when Reverend Waldo died when I was 16, I'd already, you know, Mama got saved when I was 10, and so 10? Yeah, 10. And so I had been in from 10 to 16 in this love language, in this love environment with this loving God. And so after he passed and the pastor that came in after him, you know, preached the first anti-anything I'd heard sermon, you know, it's like, wait, God coming against people? I don't know that God. You know, I went home that night, and, you know, after we'd had Sunday dinner, my brothers were inside watching, you know, whatever Sunday night variety show came on. I went out on the porch, you know, in these projects and prayed. I was like, God, I don't understand. You know everything. This is a little, you know, a young 16-year-old man who has had a, you know, young 16-year-old teenager who has had a 10-year-old, you know, a 10-year-old's relationship with God. So I was like, I don't understand, because when I prayed about my grades, you helped me out with tests. And when I was scared about, you know, what I was going to do, you just, because I'm thinking God was like in my ear helping me with tests and in my ear keeping me safe. And in, you know what I mean? And so I said, you were always there. You know everything. So how all of a sudden, you know,
is this man talking about you hate me about something that you've known about me since I've known you? I said, so look,
right.
I need some sort of sign. At 16, I'm proud to say I was still a virgin. So I was like, I haven't even done anything. If you want to take it away, just take it. You know, it's just liking somebody or, you know, thinking I like somebody. If it's wrong, take it. But, you know, give me some sort of sign that you still love me, you know. And, you know, I kind of said that in tears on the porch and, you know, came inside and went to bed. And I went to school the next day. And a young brother came to me, and he said, you know, he hemmed me up as we were walking down the hall. And he said, what are you doing after school? I was like, you know, 3 days a week I would go to the library, not just to study, but because I like the library. He said, so can I go with you? And I said, sure. And on our walk to the library, he said, I don't know what it was, but something last night told me to tell you that I like you. And for me, God was that present. It's like, I need a sign from you, God, that you still love me, and if it's wrong, take it. And if you're okay with me, show me a sign. And so for him to say something told me last night to tell you that I like you, for me, that is, was, and will always be God. So as much as people have struggled with all of that, what people say and what pastors say and what preachers say, I know who controls the on-off switch on Kevin Edward Taylor, and it's not a man or a woman. And so as long as God calls me up to wake up, I get up, and I rise when I get up. I don't just get up. I rise when I get up. In full authority with all power.
Your face is pure sunshine, Kevin. I love that picture that I took of you where your head is tilted back and you're just smiling. I believe you. I believe you, and you have just touched me just moments ago, something that I'll never forget on my journey. So you emerged from that pretty smooth on faith and your belief about what you were taught by the minister that was blind. So the question that I have for you, as a minister, what is the biggest misconception about the role of a minister?
You know, I think that the biggest misconception about the role of a minister in our community is the struggle of authority, because so many of us in the African-American culture in various ways and for various reasons went unfathered, you know, a lot of times the pastor can take on that fully authorized authority role. So what he says goes, what he says is the gospel truth. And so sometimes we don't allow ourselves to immerse ourselves in the word. It's what somebody said. And sometimes those people were illiterate. Sometimes those people were dealing with their own demons. Sometimes those people were telling you don't do something while they were doing two or three something else's. And so when the word says to study to show yourself approved, I appreciate the pastor for being the guide into the word. But if I'm going into the word, it's like a guide through a museum. You can tell me what the highlights are, but you can't stop my eye from being attracted and drawn to something else in the museum. So yeah, I think the misconception has always been, you know, even from back in biblical days when they pulled, you know, whatever the word was, the Torah, you know, out of this holy place and read a piece of scripture, rolled it back up and put it back away. You know, that time has changed. And so even when your pastor says, go with me to Ephesians 5 and 9, nothing except your own limit stops you from reading Ephesians 5 and 8 and Ephesians 5 and 10. And sometimes we still don't read the scripture before it or after it. We don't want, you know, when pastors start, you know, demonizing, you know, Leviticus 18 and 22 says you shall not lay with a man as you lay with a woman. It's an abomination. I'm saying, pastor, you have a tattoo. That is Leviticus 19 and 27. So how are you in the pulpit with a tattoo if we're following the Levitical code? And as a matter of fact, you have on a wool suit and a silk tie. That's breaking the Levitical code too. So explain to me how you can harp on Leviticus 18:22, breaking Levitical code all around it, but I'm supposed to be broken because of what you said.
Right.
We're not Levites. We're
and
not
you know
Levites.
What, and that's,
so because you don't move out of the house when your wife or daughter get a period, we're not following the Levitical code. Got it?
Right. So I won't even go into trying to decipher that because the Bible is such a powerful tool. And,
so powerful.
I just love the way that you understand that. I tried to read the Bible early on in life, and, you know, after Genesis with, you know, the number and begat this, I kind of lost, you know, my way in it. It's like, okay, I have to figure out about all the relatives just to get to the meat of the problem, but most certainly I do love his anger endures but a moment, but weeping endures but a night, but joy comes in the
morning.
I love my parts, and I certainly did just like you. I took the love that I learned from the church and took that away from it to build my own spiritual foundation and my relationship with God.
And people and here's what's so important, King. What people have to really get as we go through this struggle, this new and this old and new testament, is that, you know, God, the Most High God, the Spirit of the Living God, who created us and sees us as creation, never understood how we didn't get paradise. It's like, how did you mess that up? I gave you access to everything. I gave you everything. Who told you you were naked? How did you mess that up? And if God hated us, God would have never taken on flesh to come as Christ. God came to understand us. Like, let me understand your struggles. That's why in the Old Testament, there's all of these, you know, damnation about homosexuality. Yet, but Christ never spoke on it because he's like, I get all of this strife that all of y'all are going through. The one of you without sin, you cast the first stone. You know, Jesus says, you know, love the Lord God with your whole mind, your whole heart, your whole soul, and the second law is as the first. Love your neighbor as yourself. It was like all the rest of this, you trying to make yourself be better than somebody else doesn't excuse you from having to deal with the stuff you're dealing with. So stop trying to throw people under the bus so you can be holier than thou so that you can then say, I don't have to deal with my stuff. We each have come here to work out, you know, as grandmama used to say, work out your own soul salvation.
Amen. Amen. I love that. And we could do just an episode on spirituality alone, but what I want to do is I definitely want to allow the listeners to hear all the beautiful dynamic dimensions of you. So let's go into the television work. What was it like working in television?
Man, for that boy who sat down on the couch and interviewed Natalie Cole, what I'd like to tell people today is my first interview was Natalie Cole.
Oh.
I went into BET in 1991 as an executive assistant to the woman who ran the music department. A year later, that woman promoted me to the music researcher and record label liaison because she's like, I don't want to lose you, and, you know, you can do more than the job you're doing. Now, a year later, the year after that, 1993, that woman, Miss Lydia Natalie Cole, went on maternity leave, and a woman by the name of Cindy Mahmood took over the music department. She was already running the entertainment department. And one day we got an interview with Natalie Cole. She was just about to release Take a Look, which was her follow-up to Unforgettable, which won as many Grammys the night that she was up for Grammys. She won as many Grammys for Unforgettable as Michael won for Thriller.
Wow.
Thank you. People don't realize that. Michael won eight Grammys that night, but one of the Grammys was for Captain EO. So he won seven Grammys for Thriller. Natalie's Unforgettable won seven Grammys. So it was a big deal, I'm telling you, that when it was time to follow that up, it was a very big deal to see what she was going to do. And she came up with the Take a Look album, and Cindy Mahmood, who was the vice president of entertainment and music, said, I want you to go home and write some questions, you know, for Natalie Cole. And, I'm floating on cloud 99 writing these questions. I come in to meet with her the next day thinking, oh, my God, somebody's going to ask the questions I wrote to Natalie Cole. And I'm thinking, you know, it's going to be Donnie Simpson. That's what I'm thinking. He's the host of Video Soul, our number one show. She's huge. So it's got to be Donnie Simpson. And she sits me down and reads my question. She goes, oh, I remember this distinctly. She said, oh, I didn't know that Natalie was the first black, you know, African-American artist to win Best New Artist. I said, yes. And then she said, this is very intriguing. You got some great stuff here. So I've decided who's doing the interview. I'm like, okay. She said, you. And I was like, what? Wait, what? For what? She says, I don't know. I said, for what show? She said, I don't know. Create it. And I was like, wait, this doesn't make any sense. This doesn't happen like this. And she says, this is how it's going to happen for you because there's something about you. And so literally I left her office in a dizzy. And the first thing I did was to walk over to the art director and say, Cindy just said, I'm going to create this show. I don't know what for. I don't know what the show is, but can we meet in a week so that I can develop an open? And so over that week, I created a show called Lyrically Speaking in 1993. And Natalie aired, and then Luther said, I want to do that show. Then Luther aired, and then came Anita Baker and Lena Horne. I interviewed Patti LaBelle and Stevie Wonder in the same week. And I went to Germany to interview Tina Turner before she came to America for her Never in Your Wildest Dreams tour. So that's what it was like. It was Tina Turner, and and being able to hear a voice on the other side of a cubicle in our entertainment sections asking the guy, who is that? He's like, I don't know, some dude that they're trying to get us to do a piece on a screen scene. He hands me, you want to listen to it? He hands me the CD, which I'd like to clear up now. It had a rug and a gold lamé shoe on a carpet on the cover. I listened to this album for a day and fell in love, called the record label, and then they sent me a video for Till the Cops Come Knocking, which I started to play in heavy rotation, even when Maxwell was barely doing top 100. And people think that I fell in love with Maxwell because of what he looked like. Maxwell's album didn't have Maxwell's picture on it, so I had no idea
it
what
sure
he
didn't.
Looked like. So that, to be able to put your hands on somebody's career when they said, oh, yeah, we hadn't been able to get enough steam at radio, and to say, send me the video, and then to convince my coworkers and the woman who runs the music department to listen to the song for them to then fall in love with it, to then support it, and then we make somebody's career, that's what it was like. Like stuff I can't even put my brain around. You know what I'm saying? I can't even wrap my brain around somebody sat in the studio and poured their heart out in this album, and it almost didn't become the success it was, except that my ear heard a song and then, you know, passed that listening and that hearing on to other people who then got on board, and we as a network were able to get behind him, that we as a network were able to make Rachelle Farrell's album at Capitol Records go gold when the label had given up on the project. And Gary Price brought her into LP and did a performance of her and Will Downing. Nothing has ever felt like this, and we put it in rotation. That's what it felt like.
And when I asked you what it felt like, you gave it to me without any breaks. And I got to tell you right now, I'm still digesting it. And so if I'm still digesting it, you lived it. What was it like? What I mean, outside of that, what were you feeling inside while it's
Honestly, like a schoolboy every day, you know? Because you're working in it, I had to maintain my sense of composure. But, yes, there were days when, like, let me tell you, it started from the gate, because before I ever got to be a producer, I came to BET in March of 1991. Black Music Month that year, we were, you know, in late April, early May, we were talking about, all right, Black Music Month's coming in June, what are we going to do? And I was like, let's have Diva Weeks, you know. Donnie Simpson at the time had a two-hour show for Video Soul, and I was like, let's dedicate it to honoring, like, some of our iconic women. And we literally put out a call to all of the labels. And Diana Ross came in, Chaka Khan, Gladys Knight, Patti LaBelle. And I remember especially in dialoguing with my boss, fighting for Phyllis Hyman to be on that list. And she was like,
I was
going to
ask
really
you about her.
And she asked me, is she really a diva? And then she's talking about it from a sales point, not a performance point. You know, is she really a diva? And oddly enough, Phyllis Hyman was going to be in, because D.C. was a huge Phyllis Hyman market, and she was going to be out at Wolf Trap, which is this amazing amphitheater outside of D.C. So my boss and her husband and I went to see Phyllis Hyman, and mid-concert, while she was singing Living All Alone, she starts whistling during the bridge, and my boss would call her label and book her. Call a label and book her. So, she was amazing. And to be able to see, like, when Patti LaBelle is sitting on, Phyllis Hyman is the first hour of her show, then she had to leave to go do a video shoot for I Don't Want to Change the World. But when it was time to present Patti LaBelle with her flowers, Phyllis Hyman stayed so she could present Patti her flowers. Patti made her sit down. They kissed. She said, girl, I got to go. And, you know, to see that moment where a diva presented flowers to a diva, and she wanted to do it because they were both Philly girls, you know, was both Pennsylvania girls. It was just crazy to my brain, you know. And then Phyllis Hyman had never had a number one hit until the video she shot after that. She shot I Don't Want to Change the World, which was her only number one single.
My God.
So
and
it's that kind of stuff where you're like, how did this, who am I, why is this?
I'm telling you right now, I'm sitting here going, and I'm there with you, but you actually lived it, you know. And then, of course, you know, tragically, Phyllis Hyman left us shortly after that. So you've worked with legends, and to me, you're a legend in your own right. So the question I have for you is, what were some of the personal revelations you discovered during your time at BET?
I think that the greatest of them was realizing how much you know, artists who are people that people are used to hearing, how important it was then to know that they had been seen as well. So sometimes in those interviews, it was overwhelming to me to be able to sit with somebody and give them a story on, you know, related to a song or being in a concert and seeing them, and how rich that experience was to me, and seeing it land on them a certain kind of way. You know, I remember, Tina Turner, when we did our interview, you know, there was a moment when she was talking about how her music started to be played in America. And she said, you know, there was a DJ, you know, who got it and decided, you know, who got it from one of those international record pools and decided he was going to play it in America. And it was pretty influential here in New York. And she said, and she couldn't think of his name, and it was really just kind of this moment where I could see her like, oh God, how did I forget his name? And I'm on camera talking to a black man, and it's a black man who jump started Tina Turner's career, not Ike and Tina, but Tina Turner, the individual icon. And here she is on camera trying to walk her way through it, and she's like, you know, she looks up in this moment of like, I can't. Bewilderment, and then there's a space of grace in it that's like, Lord, help me. And she came back down kind of clear, I don't have it, let's just move on. And it's all of this is happening in a matter of seconds. And when she comes back down to look at me, I'm mouthing Frankie Crocker. I knew who it was, and so I mouthed Frankie Crocker. And she goes, yeah, Frankie Crocker. And da-da-da-da-da. And she said he was rather attractive, and I was like, yeah, absolutely. And then we kept talking. And then when we had to change tape, she looked at me and she said, I like you. You're different. You're not like other people. And she ripped the skin off of me, but I realized what she was saying in that moment, you know, was that most other people would have said it out loud to keep the interview going or to just say, I know who you're talking about. But I understood in that moment that it was a soul moment for her. His name had to come out of her lips, not mine.
Wow.
And so to see those moments with people, you know, to have those real moments, you know, when Anita Baker was, everybody's like, oh, she's so hard. I was like, Anita Baker's not hard. Anita Baker is a little woman in charge of a big empire. When Anita Baker's in concert, the lights, the tickets, the seats, you know, the state, everybody in that building is there because of Anita Baker. You can't just brush that off. You can't dismiss the 4'11" woman, the tiny woman, because you think you're looking at a woman. You're looking at an institution. You're looking at an industry, and she will be respected accordingly. So when we had a conversation, before we even started talking, we talked about, you know, how I felt that nobody was pit against each other anywhere in the entire industry, like black female vocalists. Because remember, you know, everybody was saying that Toni Braxton was the new Anita Baker. Natalie Cole was the new Aretha Franklin.
I remember.
Mariah Carey was the new Whitney Houston. I was like, but where are the other three going? And it was this way of always, and I don't know where it came from, this always dig of pitting people against each other. And, you know, and Anita told the story of, you know, when she got the Love Should Have Brought You Home last night, the song that made Toni Braxton a star, came to Anita Baker to do it. And it had Toni Braxton's voice on it. And Anita Baker said, I don't know who this girl is, but this is already her song. No, thank you.
Well, so behind the scenes, I mean, I'm going to have you back on the show. If I look at the time, it's about 6:40, something like that. We got about 6 minutes. So what I want to do, I definitely want to have you back, and I hope that you come back and I'll do a longer show with you. But before we part today, I know that you're working on a couple of projects, Now What? But then you're also working on, you have released a book that I definitely want to read. It's called Meet the Hendersons. So where can the book be purchased?
So as of Valentine's Day, the book Meet the Hendersons can be purchased in my store on www.kevinetaylor.biz. You know, I'm a self-published independent guy because I want to be able to maintain control. And so it'll be there. If you go to my Facebook page, Kevin Edward Taylor, I'm doing pre-sales already. Last Monday I sent out, good God, 3 or 4 different crates of books already. So I'm really grateful that the book is already selling well. 2 dings have happened since we've been talking to people buying books, so I'm excited about that. And so everything Kevin E. Taylor can be found at the site. You can go to kevinetaylor.biz to the store. I think it says buy the books. And then you can go to the Watch Now section to watch my series, Now What? every week, and I'm actually I stopped editing the Kelly Price episode in order to talk to you, and I'm really excited to hear people really hear from Kelly Price, you know, because R&B Divas was a format that really had people kind of demonizing her, and I was like, you know, and that's what happens when a woman is strong about the way she shows up. We throw B words and C words and these other words at her. And, you know, if those were men in those same positions, we would have, we even gay men, we'd skirt right past it. And so it was really important to have some really important conversations with Kelly, especially about the isms of the music industry as an out, you know, as an out black gay man, as a bigger woman. And I'm a big black man. You know what I mean? I'm 6'2", 270. I'm a big dude, dreadlocks, big voice. And so I know what it feels like for, to have people say, come on now, be less you. You're being too much. You're being too much. You know, and, you know, I can't quiet my voice. I can't turn my baritone into a soprano, you know. And,
but you know
and
what
and
I
Kelly,
have to say about that? Being you is what got you where you are.
Hello? Hello?
How dare they? How dare they?
But say say that, Ken, because that is so imperative. Say that again. Being you
how dare
is what got
they
you,
you
where they are. And, you know, and
exactly.
So let me, can I take your statement? Being you is what got you where you are. How dare you? Don't ever let anybody let you play quiet. How dare you play quiet when being so perfectly you got you where you are?
I think
your swagger, it's your snap and your stroll. It's who made us who we are. It's what got you on radio show. It's what got B. Slade out of gospel and in his own skin. It's what got us to who and where we are. And, you know, let me tell you this. I'm going to leave with this. I always tell people haters are confused cheerleaders who would do you differently if they were you. That's all it is. They keep watching your life and say, oh, I would do that differently. But they can't because they're too busy sitting in your audience.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Today we have had a wonderful 45 minutes, not nearly enough, Kevin. Promise me that you're going to come back and do part two with me.
I promise you. Anytime you ask, I'm here. I promise you that. Anytime I can be in a space of grace, what?
Oh. I am just, you just got a new, you just got a bigger fan in me, I got to tell you. I've always been a fan, and I remember when Robert Wesley Branch interviewed you, I just thought that you were incredible, and you definitely did not let me down. So with that, I want to say, listeners, we are in Black History Month. I started the segment with a tribute to Rosa Parks. Just know, from two men here today that are following their dreams, one is, well, definitely all in his, and you could be anything that you want to be. Let nobody silence the courage in you. And I just want to say thank you for making A Touch of Grace 30,000 strong, and promise me you'll come back to listen to part two of the Kevin E. Taylor interview. It gets even better. All right, Kevin, I want to let you go back to your editing of Kelly Price.
All right,
because
I so appreciate you.
Well, I appreciate you too, my friend. You be in touch, okay?
All right, I will indeed.
All right, bye-bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a wrap. It has been incredible. That's my favorite word. Lionel Richie said it during the American Music Awards, outrageous, well, incredible is mine. So you guys have an incredible rest of the week. Take care. This is GD signing off.